Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
BBC.
You're with the BBC, where we've science every day. This is Science in Action, and I'm John Stewart. Coming up, glaciers around the world are melting, threatening water supplies.
There has been no net accumulation since 1947 at the top of this mountain, which is at the headwaters of the Ganges, the Indus, and the Brahmaputra rivers.
As well as the Himalayas, we'll discover what's happening to the ice on Kilimanjaro. And then we'll go to the Alps, not for ice loss this time, but insect damage. Also this week, how high and low pressure fronts can affect not only the weather, but the Earth too.
There's some evidence that suggests that atmospheric pressure, say, associated with tropical depressions, could trigger, say, earthquakes, for instance.
So we're starting this week with two pieces of research which made us stop and think in the Science and Action offices this week. Unexpected discoveries that needed scientists to look at things differently and consider ideas that others have missed. First up, new research that could lead to better earthquake prediction. Professor Seth Stein turned traditional thinking upside down. When small earthquakes hit the center of the United States, people have usually assumed that they are new seismic activity and could even be a warning that a big quake is on the way. But Professor Stein and his colleagues realized that they could actually be aftershocks, the small earthquakes that can continue to shake the ground after a large one. What's so surprising here, though, is that these aftershocks could be from quakes hundreds of years ago.
We were looking at the New Madrid earthquake zone, which is an area in the central U.S. that had magnitude 7 earthquakes in 1811 and 1812. And we were making GPS measurements across it and found absolutely no motion, which is a real surprise because the way earthquakes work is you store up energy in the earth and you release it in earthquakes. So ever since GPS came online, we've been going around the world and measuring that strain building up that will come out in the next earthquake.
So that's using satellites to make really, really accurate measurements of movement.
Yeah, the measurement accuracy now is well under a millimeter a year. So nothing's moving, no sign of a big earthquake on the way. And yet there still are, you know, small earthquakes there today. So we thought about this, and then the obvious thing that jumps out at you is, well, they're not telling you that a big earthquake's on the way. They're echoes of the one in the past. The way to think about it is this. Aftershocks happen because after a big earthquake, you've changed the stresses on the fault plane, and it takes the fault a while to recover. So after a big earthquake, the fast motion across the plate on a plate boundary will swamp out all the transient effects of the earthquake within about 10 years. But in the middle of a plate where you're loading very, very slowly, it takes you a very long time to overcome those effects of the last earthquake. So 100 or 200 years after a big earthquake, the single biggest effect going on is the effects of the last earthquake.
If these smaller quakes aren't actually perhaps what people have always assumed, a warning of a coming earthquake, but in fact, like you say, just the reflection of a past earthquake, does having this knowledge help us in any way predict future earthquakes?
It tells us the following, that what we've been doing up till now inside the continents, where we have no theory to predict where earthquakes will happen, is we've been looking at maps of the small earthquakes and saying, that's where a big earthquake's going to happen. So that was the reason why some people said, for example, the big earthquake in Sichuan province in China was a surprise, because there hadn't been many small earthquakes there. We now realize that that's not probably the best way to think about the problem, that the odds are good that a lot of the small earthquakes you see are aftershocks, and instead you're better off using the GPS data to look at where you're building up strain. So to me, the big earthquake in Sichuan wasn't a great surprise. People who thought about, from a GPS side, thought it was a very reasonable place to have an earthquake. But if you thought about it from the where small earthquakes happen side, then it did seem like a strange one.
How would you actually use that GPS data? How does that work in helping you predict?
Basically, what it tells you is how much deformation you've stored up that you could conceivably get out. So in other words, a millimeter a year, if you have a millimeter of your motion that you see in GPS across a fault, and it's been 1,000 years since the last earthquake, you know you can get a meter out of that fault, which is about a magnitude 7. It doesn't
so
tell
it's
you.
It's been building up and building up and building up, and were it to rupture, that's how much movement there is.
That idea is actually one of the first things that was the key conclusions that came out of the famous study of the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco that more or less defined earthquake seismology, was the whole idea of what we call elastic rebound, that you store energy in the earth and then you release it. So the other way to think about it is there's a U.S. carnival game called Whack-a-Mole. It's a carnival game where you hit with a hammer at, you know, plastic moles, and the mole, of course, pops up in another hole other than the one where it went down.
Pops and up randomly, and you've got to try
trying to see it and hit it. Expect it to show up where it went down is not a very good way to do things.
Right.
So it's giving us a kind of different view, and it's pretty much, this is part of an overall view that has been coming out of our GPS studies at New Madrid, namely that faults and continents switch on and off. We call the earthquakes episodic, clustered, and migrating, so that unlike the San Andreas, where, you know, the earthquakes just keep happening, you know, every couple of hundred years for thousands and thousands of years, within continents, a fault system will turn on, it'll have earthquakes for a while, then the earthquakes, that'll shut down, and earthquakes will go somewhere else. We're just starting to grapple with the implications of that, but this is pretty clearly part of the same pattern of behavior.
Professor Seth Stein from Northwestern University in the U.S., and that work is published in the journal Nature this week. Next, from earthquakes to landslides and more unlikely-sounding findings. Landslide movement can be triggered by a change in air pressure. The slipping of earth and rocks is an extremely damaging event, causing deaths, injuries, and property damage costing billions of dollars a year around the world. And it seems that lower atmospheric pressures can result in less friction to hold the landslide in place. Bill Schultz from the U.S. Geological Survey looked at the slip speed of the Slumgullion Pass in Colorado in the U.S.
Well, what we noticed pretty much right away was that the landslide did move every day. However, it only moved during parts of each day. And when we looked more closely at those parts of each day, we saw that there was kind of a regular period during which the landslide would move. And looking closely enough, we realized that essentially it moves every 24 hours and also every 12 hours. That seemed to us a very odd cycle, but obviously it had something to do with daily fluctuation in perhaps meteorological conditions. So when we look more closely at our meteorological measurements, we observe that atmospheric or barometric pressure, if you will, also was fluctuating on this 24-hour and 12-hour kind of cycle. And those fluctuations are related to atmospheric tides.
So you saw these two patterns. I guess if you put them on a graph, you would see an up and down pattern in the movement of the land and then an up and down pattern in air pressure. And you overlay the two, and that's where you saw the match.
That's exactly right. And we observe that the movement occurs during the periods of atmospheric low pressure.
What do you think is going on?
First, I guess let's consider how a landslide works. This landslide, similar to most, consists basically of a layer of soil or rock that slides along a discrete surface. If you consider a book as an analog to a landslide, say you set a book on a table, and you lift up one side of that table and continue to lift it, eventually you get steep enough that the book will slide on the table. What happened there was gravity, essentially, overcame the frictional resistance to movement between the book and the table. If you do that same exercise, but this time you press down on the book, you can get the table inclined more steeply before the book slides. However, if you take your hand off the book slides readily. What you've just done is decrease the pressure applied on that book, and when you decrease that pressure, you decrease the friction between the book and the table. Well, that's essentially a very similar thing to what's going on at the landslide. The atmosphere is now, well, you, essentially, and the landslide is the book. The atmospheric pressure drops with these daily fluctuations, just as though you just removed your hand from the book, so the landslide moves.
Do you think atmospheric pressure could be having other impacts that we haven't even considered before?
Yeah, I think so. There's some evidence that suggests that atmospheric pressure, say, associated with tropical depressions, could trigger, say, earthquakes, for instance. Earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, movement of glaciers, movement of landslides, all of these processes primarily involve sliding of soil or rock along a surface. So at kind of their most basic sense, basic element involves that sliding, so these processes are inhibited by frictional resistance. That frictional resistance is largely an effect of the total pressure, if you will, that's applied to that surface. And that pressure comes from the weight of soil and rock, the groundwater pressures, and apparently atmospheric pressure as well. So perhaps any of these phenomena could be triggered by atmospheric tides or extreme atmospheric low-pressure systems, say associated with tropical depressions or something like that. We've developed a mathematical model to try to explain our observations, and it suggests that although this landslide is very thick, on the order of 40 meters or so, atmospheric low tides should have greater effect, actually, on thinner landslides, which oftentimes are perhaps more dangerous and damaging than large deep landslides because they move, shallow landslides frequently move very quickly. We've got to perform some further research to see if, in fact, shallow slides or other processes such as earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, and glacier movements are also being triggered by atmospheric low pressure.
Does this actually mean, though, that we could use weather forecasts of incoming high or low atmospheric pressure to help predict whether some of these events are going to happen and how bad they're going to be?
That's what we would hope, yes.
Bill Schultz, whose research has just been published in the journal Nature Geoscience. You're with the BBC. Nanoparticles are increasingly used in medicine. They can be used to deliver drugs to specific sites in the body, and so they're playing a larger and larger role in the fight against cancer, for example. But the ultra-small size of these particles means that they behave in unusual ways, and we don't fully understand any possible side effects. A report published in Nature Nanotechnology suggests that they can damage the DNA of cells, even in organs that are usually well protected by barriers in the body, like the brain. I spoke to one of the team behind the work, Dr. Gev Babra from the University of Bristol in the UK, and he explained that they created a model of one of these barriers in the lab, and then they exposed it to the types of nanoparticles that can be made when metal joint replacements rub and wear inside the body.
We grew these this cellular barrier on a porous membrane, and beneath that membrane we had human fibroblasts in culture medium. We exposed the human fibroblasts then to these cobalt chromium nanoparticles.
Human fibroblasts, just human cells?
Human cells, yes. Again, commercially available, very easy to use and work with, which is the only reason we use those cells, just to see what the effect was. We then exposed the fibroblasts to cobalt chromium particles, either indirectly, so across this cellular barrier that we'd created, or directly, so with no barrier in the way, and also through just the porous membrane without any cells on top. And we found that when we measured DNA damage in the human fibroblasts at the bottom, we found that the level of damage after indirect exposure was the same as that after direct exposure. And in fact, the level of damage after indirect exposure was greater than that seen after exposure through the porous membrane on its own, which led us to believe that the barrier cells themselves were having some sort of effect. There was some process going on in the barrier to cause this DNA damage in the cells below.
So somehow some sort of message was getting through.
Absolutely. And in fact, we measured, the obvious first question was, is the metal just getting through? And we measured the levels of metal in the media below the barrier and found that they weren't elevated, so there was no metal getting through. And we tested the integrity of the barrier to see whether after exposure it was becoming leaky, and that was not the case either. And we know that certain cells in close contact, like the cells we used in our barrier, communicate with one another through junctions called gap junctions. And we used a number of chemical compounds to block these gap junctions and so to stop the cells from being able to communicate with one another. And we found that in the presence of these compounds, the damage we were seeing after indirect exposure was prevented. So, you know, we can conclude from what we've done is that the nanoparticles can cause damage across our cellular barrier, and that this is dependent on a process of cell-to-cell signalling within the barrier rather than because of passage of metal through the barrier.
Now, as you've been careful to stress, this is early work, it's work in a lab, but can we extrapolate anything from what you found to what might apply in the body?
Absolutely not at this stage. This is purely to look at a mechanism of cell-to-cell signalling and whether cell-to-cell signalling could have any play in DNA damage mechanisms. And really, it's only at that stage at the moment. There's obviously an awful lot of work still to be done before you can even think about extrapolating this to the human body.
But you are seeing DNA damage. I mean, should we be concerned?
No, not at this stage. The human body is exposed to DNA damage from all sources, such as sunlight and everything, all of the time. And the levels of DNA damage have to be absolutely massive before, you know, you see anything that you're going to be concerned about. And it's very difficult in a essentially in a petri dish in a lab to work out whether those levels of damage are going to be anything like what you would see in a human body. So it's very, very early work at the moment and really impossible to extrapolate to anything in the human body.
Dr. Gev Babra from the University of Bristol. This is Science in Action. You may have heard on the BBC World Service this week the warning that the last remaining glaciers on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania may disappear within 2 decades. The research strongly suggests that global climate change is the cause, and we'll go in depth into that research in just a sec. The problem isn't limited to Kilimanjaro, though. The BBC's Chris Morris reported from 4,000 feet up in the Indian Himalayas, headed to a glacier that's the main source of water for the River Ganges.
We'll get the GPS information later, but how much change has there been since you were last here 5 months ago?
It's a big change. We are in the line of the snow during the May.
This was the line of the glacier in May?
Yeah.
We're standing on the line?
Yes.
So all this over here would have been thick ice then?
Yeah, this has been the thick ice and this has gone back.
That's a huge, that's 5-10 metres?
Yeah, certainly more than 5 metres gone back.
And that particular glacier has in fact retreated 15 metres in just 6 months. Professor Lonnie Thompson's been studying glaciers for more than 30 years, and he's just published this latest data on Mount Kilimanjaro in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. He says the cause of the loss of ice and the shrinking of the glaciers is clear.
We know it's global climate change. The weather, it's being manifested through temperature rise in the mid-troposphere, as we believe, given the fact that the ice loss in Kilimanjaro is being mirrored by ice loss on Mount Kenya and the ruined Zoris in that part of the world, as well as all the tropical ice fields in the Andes of South America and the remnant ice fields in New Guinea.
Is there anything in the history of the glaciers of Kilimanjaro that we can learn from? I mean, are we going back to a point in time when these glaciers didn't exist before?
The longest ice core record there goes back 11,700 years. And it's interesting that you can actually look at the physical properties of the ice. That core is over 50 meters in length. And only in the upper 65 centimeters do we find elongated air bubbles, 10, 14 centimeters. And we know these form only when you have melting and refreezing taking place.
So this really is fairly unprecedented.
We believe it is. And in fact, when we did the studies in 2000, we looked for all the thermonuclear bomb tests that man has done in the atmosphere because they leave a radioactive layer. And we can measure these in the ice cores. And the 62, 63 Soviet test, the 1951, 52 Ivy test that was done in the Pacific Ocean. And when we did the analysis back of the 2000 cores, we found that there was not a 62-63 horizon preserved, but we did find a 51-52 Ivy test, chlorine-36 spike, on Kilimanjaro. Now, at that drill site, since we drilled in 2000, we have lost over 2.5 meters of solid ice from the surface down. And since this horizon was only 1.6 meters below the surface, in today's world, that would be missing.
What strikes me is we must have reached the critical point, the turnaround point, well, within the last 50 years then. If we were seeing these radioactive traces of these bomb tests and now we're not anymore, at some point recently we've flipped and the glaciers, instead of getting thicker, have started getting thinner.
Yes, and this, you know, this is the highest mount in Africa. It's over 19,000 feet high. And the disturbing thing is that we've been drilling now for in Tibet for over 25 years. And we had drilled 4 ice cores from the various mountain ranges in which we had found both the 1962-63 Soviet test as well as the 51-52 Ivy test. But in the latest drilling, which was above 20,000 feet, on a mountain called Nanunami in the Himalayas, we do not find either. So we did lead-210 dating on the core, and the surface of that ice field, the first layer dates somewhere around 1947. So that means that there has been no net accumulation since 1947 at the top of this mountain, which is at the headwaters of the Ganges, the Indus, and the Brahmaputra rivers, which indicate there, on the opposite side of the world from Kilimanjaro, that we are losing mass from the surface down also. And this is something that if this holds true for other glaciers in Tibet and the Himalayas, something that's a very recent development.
And looking at Kilimanjaro in particular, is the loss now inevitable, or is there something that can be done to stop it, even reverse it?
Well, I think one of the unfortunate parts of our climate system is that there's a lag time between the forcings and the actual climate change, and that lag is 20 to 30 years. So our best estimates is that temperatures will continue to rise to at least 0.6 degrees C warmer, even if we stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, which we're not going to do. So I think the glaciers on Kilimanjaro will disappear. We could be fortunate and have some major volcanic eruptions or some other natural variability that have always driven the climate on this planet that could slow the process. But I think their future has already been written.
That's Lonnie Thompson from Ohio State University in the United States. As the global population continues to rise, the pressures increase on food supplies. Staple foods like rice, maize, and potatoes are critical, but we're not the only ones who eat them. Underground crop pests cause billions of dollars worth of damage every year, and unlike pests that eat the top parts of the plant, they're difficult to treat with pesticides. Our reporter Anna Lacey went to the University of Innsbruck in the heart of the Austrian Alps to speak to insect and underground food web expert Michael Traugott.
It's a secret world, you know, it's out of sight and quite often out of mind. It's somehow a black box and we don't know what's going on in there. For example, here in Austria we have wireworms, which cause problems in maize or also in potatoes. They are a major pest worldwide, so you can find wireworms all over Europe or the Northern Hemisphere. They even are present in Australia. But actually, we don't know very much about their feeding behavior.
Klaus Schallhardt is a PhD student at the University of Innsbruck and is in charge of some of the wireworm field experiments. He told me about the damage they can cause to crops.
We have, for example, problems in maize fields that the wireworms feed on the roots, and so the plants fall over if the roots are diminished.
And what about the potatoes here? We're standing in a potato field right now.
Yeah, the potatoes is a different problem. The wireworms feed on the tubers, so the tubers, they have spots everywhere and holes, and so they can't get a good price for the potatoes anymore.
So what are you trying to do to try and help solve this problem?
As a result of the fact that most of the insecticides don't work on wireworms or are forbidden, we try to put trap crops, let's call it trap crops, in the fields, which are plants that act as alternative food sources, so that we lure them out of the maize plants and into our trap crops.
Giving pests a tasty alternative is a well-known farming trick. But the problem with underground insects like wireworms is that no one knows what they like to eat.
You can't directly observe them, and usually these insects consume their food in a liquid state. So that means when you dissect these guys, there is no way to really identify these plant particles.
Because it's just goo, basically. It's just goo of various different plants.
Yeah, that's it. So our approach is to identify this plant DNA, which is present in the gut of these insects, and then to work out what they have been feeding on.
So I'm Karin Staudacher, and I work in Michael Traugott's group. I'm a PhD student, and most of the time I'm in the lab.
We keep the wireworms here because they have to be frozen, as the DNA would degrade otherwise.
Okay, so these are the wireworms that have come out of the field.
Exactly, so they are here in tubes.
Okay, so we've got this tiny plastic tube here and a wireworm looking very cold inside. And, I mean, how big is that? About a centimetre?
Yeah, a centimetre or 1.5. And it's orange, and they are called wireworms because they look like worms, but they are
beetles larvae, so they are insects.
So what are we going to do with the wireworm now?
Next thing we have to do is to get the DNA out of the wireworm, you know? And so we have to mash up the whole wireworm, and we use a lot of enzymes and other chemicals to get the DNA out of each cell.
After a good bit of spinning and mashing, Karen analyzes the DNA with a special machine, and the results tell her what kind of food the wireworm has been eating. Back out in the field, Klaus then uses this information to plant out a perfectly tempting wireworm feast.
Yeah, that's the mixture of different plants. We have here buckwheat, mustard, we have some beans, and some type of grasses as well.
So far, they've shown that these plants significantly reduce wireworm crop damage. But doesn't this just leave less space and fewer nutrients for the maize, which, after all, is what we humans want to eat?
In fact, in maize, it's a question of the timing. If you don't put the trap crops in too early, the maize will be really fine.
So really, the only difference is that the maize with these special trap crops is just less likely to be eaten.
Yeah, hopefully. So our results go in that direction.
I hope that these results will help creating more sustainable systems of plant production. Especially for organic farming, this is a very attractive approach because these farmers can't use insecticides and they are in strong need of alternative approaches to regulate these pests.
That report from Anna Lacey ends this week's Science in Action, which was produced by Anya Liktorovich. I'm John Stewart. Get in touch with us via our website. Look for the Science in Action pages at bbcworldservice.com. Thanks for downloading this podcast from the BBC. This is just one of the science programmes you can get. There's also Health Check, Digital Planet, Discovery, and One Planet. All our BBC Science programmes are available online. Check out the website at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.